This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on today's Trumpet Hour. I'm actually here at the Edstone Radio Studio in England, but we still have our panel of trumpet writers ready to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in Edstone, in the studio with me, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
And then back in our studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
So I've been running around and traveling for a while, and I've missed all the action going on in Jerusalem. So I know this was discussed on last week's program and on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, but I want to start today's program by going back to our man in Jerusalem, the host of our Watch Jerusalem radio program here on Trumpet Radio, and allow him to bring me and all of our listeners up to speed on the latest developments, what's happening there in Jerusalem. A lot going on these last couple of weeks. So, Brent, on last week's Week in Review, you were talking about the tension that is being caused by Israel setting up a metal detector on the Temple Mount, and this is aimed at stopping more terrorist attacks occurring there. Muslims clearly using the Temple Mount to stash weapons. So Israel puts a metal detector. This really should not have been particularly controversial. This happens all over Israel. It happens at other holy sites in the Muslim world and so on. But the story among the Palestinians was that it's Israel's first step toward taking control of the Temple Mount. And you said on last week's program that the tensions associated with Israel making this move are going to keep on ramping up as long as these security measures are in place. Now, Israel has backed down. So bring us up to speed on what's going on here.
Yeah, so over the course of Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, there was just increasing pressures on Israel from all the way around the world, around the Middle East as well, other foreign governments asking them to take away the security measures. Basically, they changed two things. They set up metal detectors at the different gates, as you said, and they also set up different cameras to ensure that they could track these perpetrators that were potentially taking weapons on the Temple Mount to then use for an attack against Israelis. Well, the pressure became so big that on Tuesday morning, early Tuesday morning, overnight, Monday night, the metal detectors were dismantled from most of the gates. And you would think that this would have caused absolute rejoicing across the Arab world amongst the Palestinians. And for a while it did, but it wasn't good enough. Israel tried to paint the removal of the metal detectors as, well, maybe that was a rush decision, but we can come up with different ways to ensure that weaponry isn't making its way onto the Temple Mount with different security cameras, different smart cameras, they're called, that can even detect weaponry on people as they just go past the camera. And because of that, the Palestinians said, well, we're still not going into the Temple Mount. We refuse, even though you've taken down the metal detectors. You've still got a change. You've still changed the status quo as they see it with these security cameras. So then it was, I think it was Wednesday night, early Thursday morning, Israel removed every single one of these security cameras. They removed these different barricades that's set up. So right now, we are back to pre-July 14 attack security measures, just the way it was before the attack took place.
It's amazing how it seems the Palestinians and the Muslim community is just so masterful at using propaganda, and it seems like they know that the West is willing to play along with these kinds of charades, and they wouldn't be able to get away with this if the West valued the truth and were not willing to play along. This would not have any traction whatsoever, and yet it really is remarkable that everybody is willing to go along with this and And it seems that it just shows you how much power the Palestinians have in terms of just the propaganda war.
Oh, yeah, they're very smart. And I mean, they just the anti-Israel bias. We've talked about this for years in the media throughout Europe, even in some places in the United States. They always come down hard on the Jews. But what's astounding to me here is everybody knows, including the Arab leadership throughout the world, including even the Muslim leadership here and the Palestinian leadership, they know Israel is not trying to change the status quo in the Temple Mount. They know Israel is not trying to exert its sovereignty over the Temple Mount to the point that they are going to allow the third temple to be built. They know Mr. Netanyahu isn't trying to destroy Al-Aqsa Mosque. And yet they perpetuate this lie that any time Israel does anything on the Temple Mount or even sets up a metal detector or even conducts an archaeological dig out near the Temple Mount, it's always to the goal of taking the Temple Mount away from the Muslims so that the Jews can have it. And this has been a lie that's been perpetuated going back till the 30s with the Mufti of Jerusalem back then, talking about how the Jews wanted to ban Muslims from going onto the Temple Mount. And now that's what the pretext was to the Second Intifada as well. You remember Ariel Sharon visiting the Temple Mount back in 2000, the prime minister. Yeah. That sparked apparently the Second Intifada, the Al-Aqsa Intifada. But before that, you had the Palestinian leadership saying that Israel was doing different maneuvers to try and take over the Temple Mount. And so when they see an act like this, when they see Israel setting up metal detectors or setting up a camera or something like that, they see it as proof of what they've been told for so many years. And right. Yet the fact is, if Israel wanted to take over the Temple Mount, they could do it in an instant, but they right. haven't.
Well, I'd like to follow up on that in just a minute, because you have an article up on thetrumpet.com that is really chilling. And I think there's a lot in there that it's worth following up on. But what does it say about Israel that they're willing to back down here? I mean, Israel is in a tight spot, and it's kind of you damned if you do, damned if you don't type of a situation. But this was the way that they chose to respond. What does it tell you?
Yeah, it was a little shocking that they removed absolutely everything that they had put in place. I thought they would have something remaining there that shows that they weren't going to give in completely. Israeli public aren't behind this move. 70% of Israeli citizens want the security measures in place, want the metal detectors in place, and they're not happy with this decision by the government, by the Netanyahu government. I think there was pressure on Netanyahu that the gains that he's made with the Arab world over the past 2 or 3 years might have been jeopardized if he maintained this security posture. He has come a long way with his relationship with Saudi Arabia, with Jordan, with Egypt. And I think that he's more concerned about that right now and maintaining those close ties that will help them against Iran rather than a few metal detectors that really yeah. Israel can probably do a pretty good job without the metal detectors of yeah. ensuring that people don't get weapons on the Temple Mount. So I don't think they're that worried. I think he's looking at the bigger picture here. That said, where do you draw the line now because you've buckled under this pressure? What about if the Arabs, I just read an article today in the J Post where some of the commentator was saying, well, we've taken away all the security measures because of the Arab street getting upset. What about if they start protesting that we have, you know, our police officers in the old city? What about if they start protesting if we at our checkpoints in the West? Like, where does it end? If you mm-hmm. keep on giving concessions over to the Palestinians, really you're perpetuating their lie by doing that.
Right. Well, it does definitely seem to legitimize these statements that the Palestinians are making and that you're hearing throughout the Muslim world, that Israel was making a power play. And because of pressure from the Palestinians, they've backed away from that because they don't want to, you know, cross that line. And, you know, I really do want to draw listeners' attention to this article that you've written. It's an outstanding article. The title of it is Palestinians Are Preparing for Another Intifada. The piece of the article that I think was so chilling was this the response of the 19-year-old who did the attack in the Jewish village in the West Bank. He was injured, but he's still around, and he's posting on Facebook and basically talking about just how every Palestinian needs to rise to the occasion with this this terrible Israeli presence on the Muslim holy site there, that they need to take up arms and do battle against the infidel. It really does show the mindset that you're up against when you're dealing with an enemy that's willing to, as you said, take any move, any kind of move or deviation from the status quo as absolute proof positive that there's a takeover in the works. I just think you did an outstanding job of bringing that out. And there is something about what that young man was saying that it gives you tremendous insight into the reality of the situation here. So we're out of time to talk about it on the program today. Go to thetrumpet.com, read that article from Brent Noctegal, Palestinians Are Preparing for Another Intifada, for more information about that tremendous, tremendous read there. Thank you for that, Brent. So moving on, one story that we've been following closely this year is the increasing military cooperation between Russia and China. This week, these two Asian powerhouses launched their first ever military drills in the Baltic Sea. To talk about the significance of this development, we're going to go to our Edmonds studio and hear from Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, starting on July 21st and spanning all the way through to today, the Russian and Chinese navies practiced war games together in the Baltic Sea. These are, as you said, the first joint naval drills there that the two countries have ever held in this area, which even before these drills was already a location of rising tensions between the West and Russia. The Chinese fleet for these war games consisted of one frigate, one destroyer, a supply ship, multiple shipborne helicopters, and a group of Marines also. And then the Russian fleet included one frigate, nine other vessels, and several fixed-wing aircraft and helicopters, and also a group of Marines. And the joint drills that they conducted included a pretty wide range of specific naval activities. It included activities related to air defense, ship-to-sea firing, maritime search and rescue, joint landing and inspection, and also underway replenishment. And now that the drills are wrapped up, over the next few days, military officials from both sides will be heading to St. Petersburg, where they'll hold a series of engagements and sign agreements that will just strengthen cooperation between the two militaries even more and just boost the China-Russia comprehensive strategic partnership in general. So this is, it's really just one more in a very long list of major indications of the growing strategic partnership between the Kremlin and Beijing. The two have been actually holding joint military exercises for more than a decade now, and they've been holding joint naval drills since 2012, so for about 5 years now. For China, these drills are a chance to put its global reach on display to the world, especially its naval reach, and also a chance just to demonstrate its support for a strategic partner. And then for Russia, these kinds of war games are a valuable opportunity to show the West that the Kremlin has friends and that, you know, Russia's not isolated, despite all those Western attempts to isolate them, especially after that 2014 annexation of Crimea. So really, both Moscow and Beijing see their deepening military partnership in general as a great way to show the world that they don't stand alone and that all the attempts by the West to isolate them over various disputes have not worked.
So this cooperation has been building over quite some time. Analysts looking at this say, well, we're still not at a formal military alliance. I wonder how far away are these two countries from actually building a formal military alliance?
Well, really, that would be, it's pretty much the only level that's left for them. They've pushed their relationship so close and so deep on such a wide range of issues that everything except for that stamp of formal alliance is really there at this point. And many analysts believe that even though their partnership still does fall short of formal alliance, that it very soon could be elevated to that level.
Okay, well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We are going to go now to U.S. President Donald Trump's Twitter account. It again made its way into the news this week as the president made an unexpected announcement regarding America's military policy. It was Wednesday at 8:55 in the morning, and he tweeted, "After consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow ... And then 9 minutes later, the suspense ended with the first of two follow-up tweets. To break the suspense for us, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, like I said, it was definitely an unexpected announcement with the president tweeting that there will not be allowing transgenders to serve or participate in the military. It's estimated that there's probably like up to 8,000 transgenders currently in the military after President Barack Obama opened that door for him just a year ago. And then with some of those follow-up tweets, he's just kind of gotten into the details that he thinks this, that the cost of the medical procedures and the psychological procedures that a transgender soldier would require is just cost prohibitive. Obviously, there's many of these people have gone through sex change surgeries. You've got hormone treatments. You've got the psychiatric counseling that goes along with the shock your body undergoes when you start injecting it with these hormones that it doesn't naturally produce. And according to the this newest announcement, this is just a cost that is hurting U.S. combat readiness and something that they want to do away with.
Now, how much evidence is there of that? It seems like there were actually quite a few people who came out and saying, well, first of all, there is evidence suggesting that with the small number of transgenders as there are in the military, that the cost of that they had to the military was actually quite small and that it wasn't hurting military readiness. And James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, was actually in the middle of a review of the policy that wasn't meant to finish until December. So there were at least quite a few pieces of evidence to suggest that, well, this wasn't necessarily a settled issue. Why is the president wading into these waters now? Do you have any idea?
Right, and probably two answers to that. And for one, I mean, I think it definitely is a scientifically settled issue that some of the costs that go along with these hormone treatments, sex change surgeries, the psychological counseling would make it more expensive to for a transgender soldier than for a normal soldier. But as you say, with an organization that employs millions of or over a million, like 1.4 million soldiers, 8,000 people in the big scheme of things is not going to be a major issue of military spending. And I think that's probably what some of these other people have brought out, is they're saying, okay, with 8,000 people, how expensive is this going to be? And it's like, well, more expensive, but it's not. If the point was only to cut military spending, there's other ways you could do that. And so it is definitely possible that President Trump, he may have made the announcement by the spending just to be non-controversial or surprisingly politically correct for something that he is doing for more moral or religious reasons. His base is very, regardless of his own personal opinions, the religious voting demographic is one of his biggest supporters. And so it could be something designed to do for them.
Well, he does seem perfectly willing to make controversial decisions in order to he's not afraid of controversy at all. And it seems like in a lot of cases, he enjoys kind of playing that to his advantage. Everybody's fighting over something like this. He spits out a few tweets and everybody goes ballistic over it. And it draws attention maybe away from some of the other things that might be occupying the headlines at the time that aren't so favorable to him. It's certainly an interesting dynamic going on in American politics with the Twitter account there. We actually have a couple more stories here about the state of transgenderism. Before I let you go, Andrew, quite a victory for those seeking transgender rights among the states, those who want to have the force of law on their side to demand that people use their preferred gender pronoun. Tell us about that development this week.
Yeah, it definitely seems like the president is kind of moving in the opposite direction of society on this issue. And they actually had two states this week, New Jersey and Minnesota, both enacted laws, authoritarian laws, making mandating, more so in New Jersey than Minnesota, but mandating that public school teachers use a student's preferred gender pronoun. Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey signed a bill into law this week that was the more authoritarian of the two laws, basically saying that public school teachers in New Jersey, they just have to call the student if it's a male and wants to be referred to as she, they have to do that, or vice versa. The state of Minnesota passed a law mandating that the state provide guidelines to teachers on how to be more sensitive to transgenders, but it stopped short of actually forcing them to call a student by whatever pronoun they wanted to be called by.
So, go ahead.
I said it is just, I kind of think, kind of linking the two stories together here, I think that's the biggest thing that struck me is just how far left American society has drifted on this issue in just 10 years, because amongst all the hubbub about President Trump being a religious zealot and doing this transgender ban for religious reasons, it is easy to forget that Donald Trump is the first president in the 240-year history of the United States to be elected on a pro-homosexual marriage platform. Even Barack Obama had to grit his teeth and lie about that till his second term. And then President Trump, he's also gone on record as saying that he's fine with transgenders or homosexual or transgenders using whatever bathroom they want. And so in many ways, he is the second most pro-LGBT president in U.S. history. And yet, because he makes a tweet about not wanting to put transgenders in the military because of the cost, the media just comes after him like he's the most religious fundamentalist that we've ever had in the United States, even though 10 years ago his position was far to the left of George W. Bush or any president before George W. Bush. And then you see the same thing kind of with this these state laws, is that even though the president's made a decision that, okay, well, I don't want transgenders to serve in the military, the government administration, both federal and most of the states, has been pretty favorable to transgenders in pretty much every other sector of society.
Yeah. Well, a couple of points you made. You said that it's so different now than it was 10 years ago. Really, it's happening far faster than that when you think about it. Barack Obama in the last election had to be against same-sex marriage to get elected, or that was his political calculus at the time. But the transgender issue, this seems like this has exploded within the last 18 months or something like that. It's been very, very rapid. And you use the word authoritarian to refer to these laws mandating gender pronoun usage. And I think that's a really important point to make, that we just don't have laws that limit speech on just a person-to-person level the way that these laws are doing. And it is authoritarian. It is the government mandating that speech be used a certain way, in a way that you just don't generally see in American society. I read an article that was one commentator that was talking about how you could say that, say, using please and thank you and those types of pleasantries is nice, But as soon as you have the government saying that you absolutely must use those or you face punishment from the law, then you're entering very different territory. Like those gender pronouns might be considered, say, polite to use them if the person prefers it, but to have the law behind it is quite a different thing. Thank you for that, Andrew. We're going to transition right now into our final segment in this first part of the program. Similar moves taking place in Britain, and suddenly it's become a whole lot easier to officially, legally change your gender within Britain. For this, we're going to go to Richard Palmer.
That's right. That will be the case under, or assuming that proposals that were outlined on July 24th by Britain's Minister for Equalities and Education get put into effect. But basically what these new laws do, previously to officially change your gender on an official government document in the UK, you had to have something signed by a doctor saying you had gender dysphoria and that you'd lived as your desired changed gender for 2 years. This new law means that people self-certify. They just have to sign a piece of paper saying, I intend to, for the rest of my life, live as this gender. And in Scotland, under the laws being considered, they could actually put no gender. So it's a radical shift when it comes to, you know, how Britain looks at these kind of things, how the government deals with the with these kind of things. That's a big change. It's a single form that it would basically then change all of that.
And this is it changes it on your birth certificate. It basically makes you legally the whatever the gender is that you decide that you want to be.
That's right.
So we actually have an article up on the website talking about this. It's written by David Vigil. The title: Britain Banning Traditional Family and Erasing Genders. And in the same article, he talks about the Advertising Standards Authority in Britain stepping in and saying we need to erase, or we need to make sure that we're not reinforcing traditional family roles in advertising. This is quite an extraordinary development as well.
That's right. There's just been several over the last couple of weeks where Britain's government has been taking these. I mean, technically, I guess the Advertising Standards Agency is slightly separate from the government, but they've been taking these radical positions. So they're saying, you know, you can't show the mother at home and the father out at work. That's wrong. And as you know, as he quotes from someone else in this article, you know, it's perfectly fine now. And one of Britain's most popular TV shows is full of rape and, you know, that kind of attack on women. That's fine. But to show her doing the washing up, well, that's too demeaning. And to me, what is most surprising, I think, about all of these is they all come from a conservative government. And there's under no stretch of the imagination is allowing people to change gender by just filling in a form a conservative proposition. I mean, leaving out whatever anybody thinks about the rights or wrongs of it, that is not conservative. You know, conservatism is about being very cautious at making changes, respecting tradition, respecting institutions that have a long history, and making a radical change to family on a whim. Well, that's huge. And I think the other thing that a few people have pointed out that's significant with this is that, again, the person behind this is Britain's Equalities Minister, but they're also Britain's Education Minister. And that's kind of, to me, that's quite a sinister thing, combining those roles. And so you can be sure as they roll this out, it's going to have a big effect on education. They already changed the law. And again, you can see the very subtle way they're working here. They already changed the law when it comes to education on this kind of thing in schools and what schools could be, what is taught in schools and transgender. They didn't change it so that they would necessarily be taught more about transgender, but they made it so that the Education and Equalities Minister can make those changes. So you can, that kind of first law sailed through with little outcry because there was nothing obvious in there.
Just preparatory.
Right. And so now you can see how the same minister that's introduced this is just going to follow up and, you know, really bring more into the schools. And one of the things we linked to on our website was a school that's facing closure, a Jewish private school, I think it is, because they don't teach anything when it comes to transgender or homosexuality. It's a So they don't teach anything, and it's a school that only caters to children up to the age of 8. Why do they need to be taught anything? I mean,
it's crazy.
But it's because they will. That's by no stretch of the imagination is not teaching anything about transgenderism or homosexuality to 8-year-olds. That's not extreme, but that's beyond the pale for British government authorities.
The pace of change is just extraordinary. It causes your head to spin to see how rapidly these, as you say, completely radical changes that will rewrite society are being implemented within America and Britain. Well, we appreciate that. Richard, you are listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about how North Korea is being supported and propped up by none other than Russia, a missile that was fired deep into Saudi Arabia and who the perpetrator was, speculation about a political comeback for a certain German politician we've been watching, and the latest sign of just how ineffective the Republican-led U.S. Senate is at getting anything done. We're going to be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
North Korea has been engaged in some very troubling behavior in recent weeks and months. If you haven't had the chance to hear it, I encourage you to listen to the first segment on this past Wednesday's Trumpet Hour, an interview with Richard Palmer about the seriousness of the threat posed by North Korea's recent missile test that put American soil within its reach. Very important development. Well, a new report says that North Korea is getting help from a source that really should concern us. For this story, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
A new report was published on Tuesday by Chusun Ilbo. That's a major South Korean newspaper. And it said that in the first 5 months of 2017, Russian exports to North Korea have essentially doubled. So this report is based on data from the Korea Trade Investment Promotion Agency. That's a South Korean government-supported organization, so it's very reliable. And it says that about 90% of these Russian exports were energy-related. So it would be coal for the most part, but also jet fuel. And then Russia is also known to export trucks and quite a few other smaller goods to North Korea. We've also talked on the show before about how Russia props up the regime in North Korea by hosting about 50,000 North Korean laborers inside of Russia. These are essentially slave laborers, so all the money that they would earn, Moscow sends directly to the government of Kim Jong-un, which the regime uses to help pay for, you know, its illegal weapons programs. And this new Chosun Ilbo report confirms that all of that is still happening. I'll just read one quote here from the report. It says, Moscow is fast emerging as a powerful backer of Pyongyang at a time when even China seems to be having second thoughts. So, of course, all of this comes at a time when the United States is really trying to isolate North Korea, trying to use international sanctions to ensure that no one is doing business with them that allows them to continue just terrorizing the world. It also comes at a time when North Korea is making rapid advances in its illegal nuclear and missile programs, which you mentioned there. And at a time when North Korea is becoming just a much more viable threat to global stability. This report about Russian support actually came on the same day that North Korea vowed to, quote, strike a merciless blow at the heart of the United States. And those sorts of statements used to sort of be scoffed at by the U.S. and the international community, but the days of laughing those things off are over. You know, the threat has become much more viable lately.
It does seem like Russia, the fact that it's giving this kind of support to North Korea, and this is really, I guess, the first that we've heard of this scale of support that Russia is providing. But it does seem particularly egregious in light of how much effort the United States has been putting forward, the pressure that it's been putting on China to curb what's happening in North Korea. For Russia to be doing this in the face of all of those efforts is really quite extraordinary.
That's right. So much attention has been called to China's support of North Korea. So much attention has been devoted to trying to, contain and curtail that support. But now we have all this sobering evidence that Russia, too, is violating those sanctions to support this lunatic North Korean regime. So it's one more area where Russia and China are cooperating, and it seems like it's largely designed just to take a jab at U.S. hegemony. There's a quote I've got here from Harry Kazianis. He's the director of defense studies at the Center for National Interest. And he said, when you consider all the different flashpoints the United States and Russia have, this is a perfect opportunity for the Russians to sort of stick it to the U.S. a little bit more. I wouldn't be surprised if in the months and years to come that the Russians were to reach out and really work with the North Koreans in a much greater extent.
Well, yeah, viewing it in light of, say, a direct affront to American interest, I think that's a very fair way of looking at it. There was actually, before we move on, another report of someone that Russia is providing support for working against American interests. You could tell us about that as well, Jeremiah.
Sure, yes. A report came out this week showing that Russia is funding the Taliban. There were documents that emerged showing that certain weaponry that the Taliban uses were coming directly from Moscow. Of course, Russia disputes this, and they say that this is falsified and it's just the West trying to sort of attack Russia. But if it's true, though, that would be, you know, just one more great way that if Russia did want to antagonize the U.S., that it would be an excellent way to do it.
Fascinating developments. I would love to keep talking about that. We've got to move on, though. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. North Korea isn't the only rogue state shooting off long-range missiles that are the cause of concern. U.S. defense officials reported that this past Saturday, there was a missile that flew hundreds of miles into Saudi Arabia. To learn who shot it and why, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so this missile was fired from Yemen and fired northward into Saudi Arabia. It traveled 930 kilometers. It's a Birkin II ballistic missile, or very similar to a Scud missile. So this is very sophisticated weaponry. It was fired, of course, by the Iranian-backed Houthi militia that basically control all of Western Yemen right now. Yemen's looks like it's about three different countries. You've got the former government controlling part of it. You've got Al-Qaeda controlling part of it, and then you have the whole western portion along the Red Sea controlled by these Houthis, and they've grown in power even though Saudi Arabia's got this coalition trying to fight against them. And as time goes on, it doesn't look like the Houthis are backing down, and it looks like they are getting their hands on some really sophisticated weaponry. I saw this video of the launch of this. It's basically like a rocket going up into space. It's absolutely amazing. They did not get this weapon. Well, they did not make this weapon themselves, that's for sure. It was definitely right. Delivered to them somehow. We've talked on this program about how they have got weapons from Iran. That's documented before. We've talked about them, this type of weaponry coming across from Oman into Yemen as well from Iran. So this isn't surprising. What's surprising is I guess, what their goal is necessarily. Just looking at a map, you can see, as I said, that they control Western Yemen. And you would think that if this was just a struggle to control Yemen, defeat the government that was there, they would try and push further eastward where the government still has a presence. And yet, it looks like they're directing a lot of their military power towards ships traveling through the Red Sea and towards Saudi Arabia in the north, which shows this is part of a wider proxy war, not just a civil war inside Yemen.
Yeah, it seems Iran would have a hard time denying their involvement in a missile launch of this magnitude.
Right. And I mean, that's the question. Where could they get it? The Chinese design weapons similar that could be used in such a fashion, but Iran has that same design as well. So no one, not even CNN, who reported on this, denies that this most likely came from Iran. I think what's interesting is not just this, how sophisticated the Houthis are now of a military force, but also the fact that they are targeting oil refineries. Saudi Arabian oil refineries in the Red Sea. We've talked about how one of Iran's programs is to control the waterway from the Persian Gulf through the Red Sea so that ships can't get out carrying oil, can't get around there into Europe. They want to control that. But Saudi Arabia also has refineries and depots on the western coast of Saudi Arabia, further north than the Houthis. So if Iran was going to disrupt Saudi Arabian oil coming to Europe or getting towards the Mediterranean, they would have to do something about the oil refineries and also the oil terminals that exist in the Red Sea off the coast of Saudi Arabia. And that looks like what the Houthis are trying to target right now. The Houthis also released a video a couple of days later saying this is a new phase in the conflict with Saudi Arabia. More refineries will be hit unless the brutal aggression in Yemen stops. So they're deliberately targeting Saudi Arabian oil.
Well, we've talked before about how the Houthis have denied a certain amount of alignment with Iran and they're acting independently and so on. But here we're really seeing an alignment of Houthi actions and Iranian interests. And this missile seems to suggest a ramping up of the material alignment between them, or the fact that the Houthis have been using Iranian weapons. So quite extraordinary. I mean, really, you have something akin to a Hezbollah-type force developing right there on the end of the Arabian Peninsula. Iran is good at what it does, isn't it? We appreciate that, Brent. We're going to move on. A man that we talk about at the Trumpet that we've been watching closely for years has been all over German headlines lately. He is former defense minister Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, Germany's former defense minister. There is talk now that he's poised to play a much bigger role in German politics. To talk about this, we'll turn to our man here in Britain, Richard Palmer.
That's right. In German media, it's been full of speculation about the possibility of a comeback for zu Guttenberg. He's about to be given a much more prominent role in the German election campaign as it intensifies. So starting next month, he's going to be traveling around Bavaria, campaigning for the Christian Social Union, that ally of Angela Merkel's party that only campaigns in Bavaria. But then beyond that, he's going to start to take a national role in the election campaign. So on September 3rd, there's going to be a debate, chancellor's debate, between the two leading candidates for chancellorship. And in that debate, zu Guttenberg is going to be there, and on TV, sorry, around the debate, right afterwards, he's going to be representing the CSU in television discussions after the debate, again, in front of audiences of millions, putting forward their position on what has gone on. And then the next day, there's a major political event at a beer festival in Bavaria. Every major German political party is sending their party leader to this beer tent festival to address the crowds there, except for the CSU. They're not sending their party leader. They're sending zu Guttenberg. They think that he has a much bigger potential to draw in the crowds at this event. So he's going to be taking that much bigger role. And at the same time, some of this news comes out about his much bigger role. Horst Seehofer, the leader of the Christian Social Union, has also been making some comments talking about his future career. He said, for example, that he wants to give zu Guttenberg a relevant ministerial office in the next German government. And that's got people speculating even that he could be the next foreign minister. Now, regardless of some of that speculation, it certainly seems, he has said he's going to reshuffle his cabinet after the election, and presumably the CSU is going to still be in, people are expecting them to still be in government, kind of in coalition with the CDU, and they're going to shake up who has what jobs. And you know, I've seen quite a few articles recently on over the last few years on the shortage of really, you know, top job caliber CSU members that they can send to Bavaria and be part of Angela Merkel's cabinet. And so people are, with that kind of reshuffle coming up and that reorganization, talking more and more about potentially zu Guttenberg being even one of those ministers as soon as September.
So it has been, 7 or 8 years since he kind of had to retire in shame. So we really see this progressive rehabilitation of his image taking place. And it is interesting to watch this happen. We've been talking about it so much to see this taking place. We really appreciate you bringing us up to speed on that, Richard. Finally, one of the biggest campaign promises that Donald Trump made in his bid for America's presidency was that he would repeal and replace Obamacare. So far, all efforts to actually follow through on that pledge have failed. And this week, yet another of these efforts crashed on the shoals of America's Congress. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, it definitely seems like the repeal and replace pledge is dead for the foreseeable future. They actually held two major votes on repealing Obamacare this week. The first one happened on Tuesday, where they basically took a vote to even discuss repealing Obamacare. And, of course, all the Democrats and two of the Republicans voted against even discussing it, which resulted in a 50-50 tie, which Vice President Mike Pence had to step in and break. So with Pence as the tiebreaker vote, they started discussing it, but then they voted this morning on what they called the skinny repeal, which is basically just repealing a few of the more controversial elements of Obamacare. But again, all the Democrats voted against it, and those same two Republicans. And then Senator John McCain kind of surprisingly stepped in last minute to vote against that skinny repeal as well, which is something that political watchers hadn't foreseen happening. So even Mike Pence couldn't break that tie. So there's definitely been no repeal now. And if they won't vote for the skinny repeal, I don't know how they'd ever vote for a full repeal.
Why is this so hard, Andrew? And what does this tell us about Congress?
Right. Well, I mean, it definitely shows that even though, I mean, people made a big deal about the Republicans having more legislative seats than any time in many, many years, there is just a tense amount of division in the Republican Party. Some of these Republican senators, one of them from Alaska, are actually from areas of the country where, like the Democratic base, the people actually want they want the Obamacare health care. And so you've got senators who are not willing to go against their constituencies to do this. And so it does show that, I mean, this is something that, I mean, you have to deal with in a democracy, is that when people want free health care, that's hard to get rid of, despite what it does to the government debt. And that really is one of the biggest things, is just the fact that here between Social Security, Medicare, health care, Obamacare, within just a decade or so, it's getting to the point where Congress is projecting that all U.S. tax revenues will go to entitlements within like 15 years. And so the interest on the debt, defense, and everything else related to running the country is going to have to be financed on borrowing. And that's something that even if they did repeal and replace, I looked at the numbers for the Trump Care proposal, and they say Obamacare was projected to spend $2 trillion over the next decade. Trump Care only spends $1 trillion, but it also cuts taxes by roughly $1 trillion, which is more money for the people. But when you're cutting both spending and taxes like that, they said it only, as far as deficit spending, the Trump Care, it was only going to save $150 billion over the next decade. And those are a lot of big numbers that are hard to comprehend. But if you, the easiest way I find to do this is to just divide by 100 million and put this in context of what if an individual family was like that. It'd be like, mm-hmm. if you compare the Republicans and Democrats in Congress to a married couple, they're spending they're making $30,000 a year. They're spending $35,000. So they're putting $5,000 on the credit card every year, even though they're already $200,000 in debt. And now they're arguing with each other over whether they should cut $150 from their annual budget.
Oh, I appreciate you putting that in perspective for us. And, you know, this does it does also suggest this has to be the highest profile defeat for Donald Trump. in terms of a failed campaign promise and his inability to bring this actually to pass, what he had said was going to happen. It does seem to be emblematic of just the stagnation within American politics and just how much the division prevents anything. Even they do seem to be able to pass new entitlements. The one time that there's an effort to try to dial some of that back, it fails miserably. I guess this is just the state of American politics today. We appreciate that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Do visit us online at thetrumpet.com. As we've mentioned, several of the stories that we've talked about here are written up in article form on the website, and some of them quite excellent. I would encourage you to go there and check that out. We're going to finish the program next with our lightning round of important news. That's coming up right away.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines from this past week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Richard.
The U.S. House and Senate just passed laws that would enable new sanctions on Russia. It passed in the Congress 419 votes to 3. The interesting thing about these is Europe really does not like them, as it could affect European oil companies. And this week, one of Europe's presidents, Jean-Claude Juncker, actually talked about putting sanctions, retaliatory sanctions, on the U.S. So with this bill moving forward now with a veto-proof majority, you've reached the point where Europe and America are talking about putting economic sanctions on each other. That's just a shocking illustration of how low transatlantic ties have sunk.
And now over to Jeremiah.
China is taking advantage of America's weak reaction to the Venezuelan crisis to boost Beijing's influence in the Latin American country. In recent years, China's been making all kinds of inroads all over Latin America, in Chile, Peru, Bolivia. All of these have been brought into China's AIIB, or Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and Venezuela is now on board in the bank too. So the deeper integration between China and Latin America is sounding alarm bells in Washington, but the U.S. doesn't look to be in any position to do anything about it.
All right, well, let's go straight to Andrew.
The United States government has ordered family members of employees at their embassy in Venezuela to leave. This announcement was made on Thursday in the wake of a political crisis deepening in Venezuela. 7 more people were killed in street protests against President Nicolas Maduro. And security experts are warning that the country could descend into civil war within the year.
Okay, now to Brent.
The online editor-in-chief of the mass circulation German paper Bild published Sunday a column filled with blistering criticism over the anti-Israel media in Germany during the Temple Mount clashes. Julian Reichelt wrote, quote, "No other country which suffers under permanent terror is reported on in Germany in the cynical, ice-cold, and heartless manner like Israel is." Then he lambasted the German press for routinely interchanging perpetrator and victim. Finally, he warned that the media attacks on Israel reveal a German withdrawal from its historic responsibility towards the Jews for what they did during World War II.
Preach, brother. All right, now back to Richard.
Libya's two main rival leaders agreed to hold a ceasefire and to have elections next year. That was at a meeting in Paris. Whether that holds or not, or how successful that turns out, is very questionable. But Europe has leapt right on this. The French president has announced plans to open migration centers or asylum processing centers in Libya to try and encourage people to go there instead of crossing the Mediterranean into Europe. And Italy is putting forward proposals to have their navy patrol inside Libyan waters. And they're trying to get, now that these two have some kind of an agreement to allow Italy to come into Libya. So you can see just the eagerness from Europe to get much more involved in North Africa as they jump on this opportunity.
Okay, Jeremiah.
China has launched a new military agency to research and produce state-of-the-art weaponry. This new agency is called the Scientific Research Steering Committee, and it falls directly under the Central Military Commission, which is chaired by President Xi Jinping. And the new organization is being compared to America's DARPA agency. So this could mean that the technological sophistication of China's military could soon get a powerful boost.
Back to Brent.
Seemingly just on cue, the defense ministers of Iran and Iraq signed an agreement on Sunday to boost military cooperation between the two neighbor countries. Based on the deal, Tehran and Baghdad will promote interaction and share experiences in the fight against terrorism, and they'll work together to ensure broader security and provide each other with training and logistical, technical, and military support. Speaking to reporters after signing the document, the two ministers expressed the hope that it would lead and result to deeper and more serious military cooperation between the two countries. Just another sign that Iraq is falling completely under Iranian control.
All right, and we'll finish with Richard.
Mussolini is back, at least on Twitter, Instagram, and other social networks. He is steadily gaining popularity within Italy. On this kind of new web media, so much so that currently the Italian parliament is trying to work out a law to penalize people who spread this kind of fascist propaganda online. But it's reached the point now that over 100,000 people within Italy have given their have named themselves or their social media profiles Benito Mussolini. And these kind of groups discussing and promoting his ideology are just receiving rapid popularity and a lot of attention.
European politics continues to surprise and baffle. I am Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories that we talked about on today's program. Give us your feedback by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to this distinguished panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
It was a pleasure.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Ibn Battuta. Traveling, it leaves you speechless, then turns you into a storyteller. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.